Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White, joined today by Bob Larson and Bob Weber. Good morning, guys.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
And we've also got our graduate student here who's going to graduate this fall, Gabby Gilliam. Good morning, Gabby.
Morning.
Gabby does the podcast and does our production on the podcast, does a great job. We wanted to share a little bit today. She just completed a study that she presented at the American Association of Bovine Practitioners on satisfaction, career satisfaction related to veterinarians. So we'll talk a little bit about that. We're also going to talk about, it's that time of year we think about marketing calves. So we're going to talk about not just value added, we're going to talk about value capture. So whether that's genetic or health or how, if we've done good things to the calves, how do we get that value back out? We'll also discuss looking at calving, and we know we've got some fall calvers, people bringing cows home from pasture to calve. They may be calving in a dry lot or a pasture situation, so we'll do some pros and cons. And we'll wrap up by talking about death loss and looking at death loss in the feed yard by different causes. So this is the end of 4-H week. Bob and Bob, I know you guys both have kids in 4-H, so good week this week.
Yeah, it's a fun time of year. You know, we finished up the fair a couple months ago. We got our 4-H record books done, which, I was a 4-H'er, and I remember just, it seemed like you had to work on those things for hours and hours, and you whine and you complain, and
you had yours done ahead of time. Is that what you're trying to say?
No. And I'm seeing this in the next generation. Oh, the whining, and it's awesome.
Yeah, National 4-H Week, and for I think a lot of folks in the ag world, 4-H was a big part of their young life. So a great chance to remember and think back to the things we learned and the benefits we got from being engaged.
It is important to realize just how much I learned from those hands-on experiences working with my folks, and other things about 4-H too, public speaking and parliamentary procedure and just working on a team. There are so many positive things that I think a lot of people appreciate that experience, but I don't think you can ever really fully give it the credit that it deserves for a lot of people.
Absolutely. There's a lot of value in working on a team and realizing that's going to be what you're going to have to do as you go through life, and working with each other is not just an innate skill. We learn that skill, and that's one of the things, Gabby, that you in your study, and I wanted you to share a little bit, because you did a study that I think is really interesting and looked at job and career satisfaction in veterinarians, and specifically in veterinarians a little less than 10 years out of school. And you presented some of this work, but I was going to ask you a couple questions today to kind of share some of this with our audience. What did you find was their biggest source of job satisfaction?
Sure. We gave them 7 or 8 different options to choose from. So it wasn't just fill in the blank, but basically what we found out was relationships are a huge part of satisfaction within your job. So both from their clients that they're working with, and then also those fellow coworkers and employers. And then also what they're doing at their job is a huge source of satisfaction. So if you're happy and you love what you're doing, then your satisfaction, of course, increases. So
more so than compensation or pay?
Yep, that's what our data said. So,
yeah, interesting. So you also asked them about what could be done to, because a lot of times we think about if somebody is not satisfied with their job, and I know in your work, about 83% of the veterinarians young in their career were satisfied with both their job and their career. But if they're not satisfied, I think you also ask, what could you do to be more satisfied? What was driving that?
Yeah, and some of that compensation does come up here. But again, it wasn't the biggest driver of job satisfaction. Actually, more time off of work and working fewer hours is what came up as something that would increase that job satisfaction.
So only about 25% of them said that compensation would increase their job satisfaction. Bob and Bob, are you guys surprised by that, or is that what you expected?
Yeah, I don't think that's really even unique for veterinarians. I think that's true for any type of a business that your relationships with others. I mean, compensation is important in that it has to be adequate, or I'm probably going to be looking for a different job. But once it's adequate, it's, well, do I enjoy coming to work? And that might be at a veterinary clinic. It might be getting in the pickup truck with my employees or my dad or whoever. Do I enjoy the people I'm interacting with all day. I think that is a huge driver. And in some ways, that's both an opportunity and a challenge because, you know, interacting with other people can sometimes be difficult.
You said that very politically correct.
It can be difficult, and I find it interesting that increased job satisfaction increases with being away from the job more. So, which speaks to maybe sometimes you need either decompression time or just time away. Because being a veterinarian, not surprisingly, can kind of be at times a real high stress job, fast pace. Maybe people, particularly I'm thinking, you know, emergency cases may not be in their most calm and polite demeanor. And so, you know, having some, you know, me time away from the shop or clinic could be really beneficial. So.
And Gabby, one of the other things that you, and I totally agree with what you guys are saying. So I think that's important to consider that it's not just if I have somebody that's unsatisfied, providing more pay doesn't necessarily fix that situation, but maybe there's some opportunities as a manager that I could get them some time when they need it, and maybe that's specific times. But Gabby also asked about what are the drivers, and you ask about a lot of different things that would be associated with job and career satisfaction. Did any themes come up throughout that you kind of want to talk about?
Yeah, we asked about some cultural type questions of the clinics and then some business management factors. But really what we saw most influential was if you received adequate recognition in your job and your career. So being recognized for what you're doing and knowing that you're playing a big role or an important role in whatever job you're doing is certainly something that veterinarians are looking for.
Yeah, and I think that's probably beyond veterinarians, right? That's
right.
All of us. And we ask a pretty simple question there. Did you receive adequate recognition for the job that you do? And the difference in the percent of them that were satisfied with their job varied pretty dramatically between those two, right?
Yeah, so if you were receiving adequate recognition, around 90% of them were saying that they were satisfied with their job. So it definitely plays an important role in job satisfaction.
Well, and that makes sense when you think about it's easy in interactions, and I'm thinking about work interactions, maybe working cattle or working in the vet clinic or something like that. If somebody does something incorrect, I'm going to mention that right away because sometimes it's something that needs to be corrected immediately. And so as someone working with me, it may seem like everything I'm saying is a negative. You didn't do this. You need to move there, you know. And that could be pretty draining if that's not counterbalanced with all the positives. Great job. Really appreciated how you did that. Gosh, I know you stayed late last night. If you don't counterbalance those, and I'm not saying don't say the negative, because a lot of times that feedback, I need you to do X, is really important. But if that's all a person hears, that's not necessarily leading to job satisfaction.
Yep. Good coaching goes a long ways and figuring out ways to say something negative in a positive way can be really difficult as a manager, but can be really impactful for the person on the receiving end of that.
So. I think even just saying something, right? Because sometimes
right?
Yeah. I don't want to say all I can think is negative, so I'm not going to say anything. And we know how Larson handles this. Sometimes he says, hey, you should go run to the parts store. Right? That's what you've told us before.
Right. So that's how we get rid of the annoying person.
That's not feedback. You're removing them from the situation.
Go play in traffic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So,
here's one quick question. So this is a suggestion for our employees, but like for our family, we probably don't need to do this. They know we love them, so we don't have to give them positive feedback, do we?
No, I think you got to give feedback. And I think it's got to be... And I agree with what you guys are saying. It doesn't always have to be positive, but you do have to have some feedback. All of us need that to figure out where we are. So nice work, Gabby. Really appreciate you putting this together and sharing with us. That was presented at the American Association of Bovine Practitioners, and we hope that a summary paper will be coming out soon. So appreciate all the work you did there and on the podcast.
You bet.
Thanks, Gabby. Good job.
We'll shift gears just a little bit and talk some about value capture. And this stems, there was an article that I put in the Angus Beef Bulletin that's going to be coming out this month. And it talked about value capture versus value added. And I will ask you guys, Bob and Bob, Bob on the health side and Bob on the genetic side, there's lots of things we do to add value to calves that really make a difference. Both genetic improvements, preconditioning programs, things to prepare those calves for the next phase of their life. Do you see people always get the value back out of them that they put into them? And if not, why not?
Yeah, some of the things we've talked about in some recent podcasts, getting those calves vaccinated, castrated, dewormed, ready for the next phase of life. Those are all things that really make that calf more likely to be healthy, more likely to perform well. But if I don't tell anyone about that, they're going to assume, that they need to consider a higher risk animal than what I'm necessarily selling. And so the marketing side of that, and I've seen some work coming out of K-State's Ag Econ department, looking at some predictors of ranch profitability, and average sale price is a big driver for the higher profit ranches. And, in any given year, we're all in the same price environment. So no one really gets to, break completely out of the price environment of a particular marketing window. But people that are more profitable find ways to add a few dollars here and there, or capture a few dollars here and there. Health is one way. So selling, not only selling the calf, but selling the information, selling the story is an important part of that.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. But I'll make a distinction in what you said. You can add a few dollars of value, but you have to have a system in place to capture those dollars back, right? Because we can give them vaccinations. We can buy better bulls. It's pretty straightforward. Can we capture those dollars back? What do you see, Bob, on the genetic side?
Yeah, I think, genetics matter, obviously. And I think really in sort of two spaces. One's, obviously the performance of those calves to create pounds of calf weaned as part of your paycheck formula, right? So, figuring out how to optimize cows in your production environment so that they're really reproductively efficient and mate those cows to bulls that provide good marketing value and performance of those calves, both to whatever your marketing endpoint is, really. So get that selection decision to endpoint aligned is really important. And then make sure, if you spend, extra money on genetics, one of the ways to capture value is retain ownership on those. If you've made good breeding and marketing decisions, owning them further in the chain typically provides you more opportunity to capture value back. But if you're still, in a situation where you have to sell calves at weaning time, and make sure that you spend some of your marketing investment, if you will, in terms of time, providing information about, we bought XYZ bulls from this premier breeder, and here's what their genetic profile was. Particularly in environments like video auctions and so forth, those either breeder or trait designations can really add some value and confidence to the buyers that are buying your calves.
So you guys have given me kind of two ways if I want to go down this path. Is one, I could transfer information, is what Bob talked about, and then I could also retain ownership, and that doesn't necessarily mean through the finishing phase. It depends on what I want to accomplish, right? So I could own them through a backgrounding phase or part of a feeding phase or all the way through or partial ownership. But to do either of those options, I really need to think about it. And I'll throw in, because Dustin's not here, we got to evaluate some of those costs and benefits. What else do I want to do to evaluate what are the best options for me to capture value? What would you guys recommend?
One of the things that I think is important is to figure out what your options are. And that might be special calf sales. It might be retaining ownership a little bit longer. Talking to your neighbors, figuring out, just having the conversations of, because again, going back to some of that Ag Econ data coming out of K-State was some of my neighbors do get a better price than others. So how do they do that? What are their methods? So get as much information as you can. I also agree with what you said before, is a lot of these things that we're talking about have an added cost. I own them longer, or I buy feed, or I buy health products. So you need to get the spreadsheet out or a piece of paper and really pencil out, you know, what my additional costs are, what my additional potential income is. And so do the homework. And, you know, for some of us, I really enjoy working with cattle. I don't necessarily enjoy being an accountant, or that would have been my career. But sometimes to really thrive as a cattleman, I need to do some of these other skills that are maybe not my favorite, but they're really important to long-term profitability.
Absolutely. And that'll help you evaluate some of those programs that are out there to figure out what's best for your ranch or your operation. That leads us to our Cattle Chat checklist this week, which is our ways to capture value on your calves.
Number 6, ensure adequate documentation on your procedures and processes that you've done to add value to your calves.
Number 5, visit with other producers that have used different methods.
Number 4, once you've selected a program, know all the procedures that you will need to do.
Number 3, calculate the potential costs and benefits for the practices you plan to undertake.
Number 2, understand what data you need to collect and record.
And number 1, determine the best mechanism for your ranch to capture value for your calves.
And those are our top ways to capture value from your calves. I wanted to pick you guys' brains on a different topic. It's that time of year as people are bringing cows home from pasture that may be fall calvers. And I wanted to do just pro, and this could apply to the spring too. I want to do some pros and cons. What do you guys think about calving in a dry lot versus calving out on pasture? What are some of the considerations?
Well, as the veterinarian, calving sanitation becomes really important. So I want those calves born in a clean environment. And, you know, the stereotypical best environment is probably, you know, grass out where they're really spread out. That being said, I've worked with clients that have made dry lot calving really work, but these people tend to really focus on enough space, cleanliness, being flexible. So if we have a wet fall in this case, or a wet spring if we're calving in the spring, having some flexibility to move those cattle around so that there's a huge difference. I like the way you said dry lot. A dry lot is fine. A mud lot is not fine.
You stole my point, Larson. I think you know, your point on sanitation is really important, and the emphasis on is it really a dry lot, right? You know, mud and muck and manure and so forth doesn't provide a great calving environment. So you know, if you're stuck in a we'll rephrase it, if you're in a confinement situation, you really need to find a way to get cows in on dry ground. And you know, if it's you got to put them in a barn and bed them and pen them, that can provide a lot better calving environment, obviously, than you know, that calf going from a 101.5 degree nice warm wet environment to a 30 degree cold wet environment.
But the positives of this are, if I can keep it dry, I can feed them more adequately, and I can keep them from tearing up some of the pasture for next year, right? That's why I would do it.
Yep. Yeah. And I think the other reason too is, you know, let's talk about first calf heifers, for example. So a group of animals you may want to provide quite a bit more observational capability on. So having them up close and in a convenient place to go and walk through cows or heifers that are getting ready to calve and make sure you've got the right ones pulled up. And so proximity may really help reduce labor. You know, if you've got to do that same exercise for 100 cows that are spread over, you know, a half section versus, you know, 4 or 5 pens, real difference in time scale in terms of the amount of time it takes to observe those cows as you go through calving season. So,
well, I wanted to throw out a thought. One of the things that we've learned, and I've talked to a couple people that were working with confined cow operations, and they said one of the things that they learned in those environments, and these were total confinement, were that the importance of having a place for those calves to go that was away from the cows. So does that apply to these dry lot pens as well?
It does, in that it's really nice to have, you know, kind of a creep area where the calves can get away. But sanitation of that area becomes really important. It's easy for that to become, calf calves have feces as well as their mothers. And so if I think it is important to have a place for those calves to get away, but the sanitation of that area needs a lot of attention. So frequent cleaning of those kind of creep areas where the calves can have a nice clean environment. And again, bedding, scraping, those types of things.
And that area can also provide additional, you know, weather shelter for those calves. And I think, you know, I've seen over the last year some really innovative ideas on, you know, how to construct those. And I think one of the key things is don't make it too tight, right? So, you know, fresh air and airflow to control humidity buildup and so forth can really aid sort of the respiratory quality of that environment.
So you're thinking if it's a
tight building. Yep.
Yeah, if you're thinking a building
that's too tight.
Yep. It's like a shade that's too short, some of those things don't achieve their desired goal of protecting them from the environment. They create a new micro environment or a small environment around those calves that may not be as good.
Right.
So overall, you guys are saying either way, you're okay either way, dry lot, as long as it's dry lot. I'll use that word again, Bob, and or pasture. And it really depends on your environment and what you can get accomplished. It also goes back to, does timing of calving matter? So if I'm going to be calving over a 60-day period versus if most of my calves are born in the first couple weeks, does that impact which type of environment you'd rather see me in?
I don't know that it matters, but it makes it easier in a lot of ways because I can manage the entire group and my calves are all in similar age. My cows are at similar ages or stages of their pregnancy. And that just makes my life easier to manage an entire group that is similar versus, you know, a group of cows that are calving over several months. Now I've got late pregnancy cows and brand new calves and older calves, and it grabs more of my management time because my cows are so different. They're in different places. So we've talked about this before on some other podcasts, but I really like working hard to get those cows tightly calving together as much as possible.
Absolutely. Cause that makes a difference in how I can manage that group. So the kind of bottom line there is figure out what works for your operation. The other thing we wanted to address, and we had a really interesting, I'll say a graph that was put together, but it was based on some work that was done by some of our folks here at Beef Cattle Institute. And if you don't get the weekly newsletter, you can send us an email at bci@ksu.edu, and we'd be happy to add you to that list. This came out, there's about once a month, and we've got Dr. David Amrine, who's our director of research here, and he works with a variety of students and faculty on different projects. This particular project, he was working with Blaine Johnson, who's a PhD student in DVM, and they looked at the average days to death by diagnosis. So how long, and this is after entering the feed yard, and Bob, I want to pick your brain a little. What did you learn from this research? And maybe you may start by telling us, if you know, how many cattle were involved or how much data were involved in looking at this numbers?
Well, one of the things that's really neat about this research is that it is able to cover a lot of cattle over a fair amount of time in a fair amount of geographic area. So it's a good average of what really happened. So we're talking about over, you know, 4.5 million head of feedlot cattle that are in this database that was looked at over a few years. And so that, you know, so you've got different times of year, different feedlots. And the reason I keep emphasizing that is any group of cattle can have a pattern that is, you know, well, it's their own pattern. But when you add them all together, you really get an understanding of what feedlot cattle in general do. And some of the results were a little bit surprising to me. One that was not surprising to me was respiratory disease tends to be the biggest part of that disease problem is in the first 2 months. You know, so we've had more than half of our cases that we're going to have by the time the calves have been in the feedlot for 2 months. And that's kind of the earliest peak. It's the disease we're going to see most frequently in those first 2 months at a feedlot. And then after that, it's certainly the risk doesn't go away to zero, but it declines pretty markedly after those first couple of months. And then that's different than some of the other disease issues that we see, then they become equally important to respiratory disease as you move past those first 2 months.
So you're saying the first 2 months, about half the respiratory deaths occur, and then the other half of those deaths occur from 2 months till the end of the feeding period, which may be a couple hundred days.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely front end, first couple of months is where the greatest risk is. But that's different than some of the other diseases we think about. When you think about some of the other things that can cause health problems in feedlot cattle, that includes digestive issues such as bloat, those types of things. That tends to be not at the front end emphasis. It's a little bit more even. So actually, once the cattle get up on feed after they've been there for 3 or 4 weeks, their risk of some of these digestive diseases is pretty flat after that time. So once they get up on full feed, their risk kind of plateaus out there. And so that's kind of fits my bias, although sometimes it feels like those peak more late, and the peak of those digestive problems is pretty subtle. It's a fairly flat curve after you get out after that first month or so.
And Blaine has been doing some work on heart disease, and I know Bob Weber, you've been involved in some of that as well. What did you see when you looked at the kind of knowing that heart disease is pretty low number, right? It's not a high percentage of the cattle, but just relative to the timing, we've talked about that being kind of late. What do you see here?
Yeah, I was a little surprised when I saw the chart. I was expecting sort of a hump towards after 150 days on feed or so, just kind of what you hear anecdotally out in the country about when we observe those heart deads in feeding environments. We know there's some seasonal effect, but this days on feed number, after really they're on feed about a month or so, I mean, it's flat as a pancake, and not a high incident event, fairly low, but obviously not zero, and really flat through, basically 25 to 175 days on feed. Really not much difference on a day-to-day risk sort of perspective. So kind of surprising.
It was very surprising. I'm laughing because I'm thinking this is probably a riveting podcast. Listen to three guys sit around describe a graph that no one can see.
No one can see. They can envision flat, right?
Yeah, but you guys using your hands. Yes,
we're using our hands to kind of show how this is supposed to work.
Super, super helpful. So, if you would like to see this graph or more like it, and we do send out those summaries about once a month, and we've done some in the past looking at some of the different risks. Most of them are on feed yard, but we had one a couple months ago related to the cow-calf and some of the calving patterns, which I think is interesting as well. But if you'd like to see those, shoot us an email at bci@ksu.edu, and we'd be happy to add you to that list. Appreciate you joining us today. And if you have questions, comments, anything you'd like us to talk about on the show, you can also email us at bci@ksu.edu.